Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He's mad. He's mad. He's madder than Mad Jack McMad, the winner of last year's Mr. Madman competition.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Bowlology Report. Joining me, Damien Fleming here, of course. Joining me, as always, the Brad, the bad boy, Hodge. And Hodgie, what about our special guest today? I've actually done an intro, which I don't normally do. I'm just going to read through it. Short in stature, but full of spirit, and with a slinging action and a great outswinger, he led New Zealand's pace attack with distinction, a genuine strike bowler, an excellent one-day bowler, a well-disguised slow ball, nagging accuracy. In his pomp, New Zealand only won two of his last 35 tests, but each time he was a key component of the win. 6 for 37 against Australia, 8 wickets against Pakistan. As a batsman, he was a genuine rabbit, once holding the record with 24 test ducks. But fitting in his final test, heroics with the bat for New Zealand, scored 14 out of 106 for the 10th wicket, with Nathan Astle saving the test match. He was dropped after that. Now a commentating force to be reckoned with, providing energy, attention-grabbing gestures, laying down, doing pitch reports, dancing with cheerleaders, turning Austin Power and type phrases into the cricket world. Good afternoon, Danny Morrison.
Gentlemen, how are you? Flem and Hodge, what a privilege.
Now, Morrison, normally you'd be dominating the IPL. What have you been doing?
Yeah, it's a different landscape now, isn't it, gents? You're right, and we're at the mall, so I've done all those IPLs. Well, I arrived late. In fact, I arrived late with you, Flynn, didn't we, in 08?
Yes.
And when I think of all of the stuff that's been going on, my great achievement over the last, say, 6-7 weeks, gentlemen, we've had to move house, and that's not a lot of fun, but luckily only 2 kilometres across the way. So, yeah, it's been hectic. And you say everyone's shutting down, but it's nice to have been home off that merry-go-round, as you both well know what it's like. And the first time I've been home, my daughter's birthday, she's an Anzac baby, so the first time since April 25th, 07, and the same for a Mother's Day in May, early May as we know, since 07. It's just been that sort of hectic time.
Did you get a truck for the move, or did you just go the whole TKs with couches on your back and all that? Because you're a strong man, aren't you?
Definitely not. No, certainly. Just, well, see, now in your mid-50s these days, Flem, I think. Flem, yes, so Hodge is a bit young, possibly, but Flem, yes. You must be just getting to 50 soon, aren't you? Aren't you 50 soon?
Raised the bat about 3 weeks ago, DM.
You had your 50. Wow. So
there I'm you into go. The so second. Definitely. Yeah. Second half.
Mm-hmm.
And Hodgie, what year were you again?
I was born in 74. Just around Richard Hadley time, I suppose. So just when he was starting to fire up. I used to love going to watch. New Zealand and Australia, actually, the MCG, one day cricket in particular. Our favourites sort of back then were, I loved Kim Hughes and Dennis Lilly, of course, but you know, it was always good to watch Hadley trying to match it with the great DK. That was pretty cool stuff. But yeah, no, I'm 45. I'm not there to version 2.0 yet. Haven't raised the bat for 50, but going on my record to conversion from 50 to 100, so I'm pretty confident I can get there, actually.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
I, Hey, Hodgie, you brought up some good points about the Australian-Kiwi rivalry. We'll get into that in a sec. But Danny, the IPL itself, you've been commentating for years before that, but it really just blew you up in a commentary sense. And, you know, what was the catalyst and the persona? You know, we talked about the pitch reports and the commentary phrases. You know, what was the ticking point? Was it the IPL itself? You just got up for T20 cricket, or was it something that evolved before that?
Yeah, well, what I've done in the past and chatting either on podcasts or getting interviewed about the scenario is that when I was 11 and 12, and when my parents split up when I was about 7 or 8, we moved from the Wild West. And that's in Auckland, and everyone's probably like Melbourne, you know, Sydney, whatever. You got this pretty wild west, don't you? And then you move to the affluent northern suburbs where my uncle was, my mother's younger brother, and we went there to rent there for a while. And it just changed the perspective of doing other things. And so in between sort of hiatus of sports, my mother, who a very thespian background, drama diploma and all that, I used to hang out with these thespian types with my mother. So at 11 and 12, I was doing some pantomime, some stand-up stuff. We'd be doing sculpturing-type things and theatre sports-type initiatives. So, again, for me, it felt quite comfortable in front of the camera. And then when I finished playing, Flem, I got, you know, Martin Crowe became the EP of Sky Sport, and that was that 99-2000 season. And so I got to head up and front Cricket Company, which was a magazine show, so you could be a little bit more risque with it, and because it was a magazine show, it's pretty relaxed, and so you could, lots of gestures, lots of fun, because it was a magazine show. And then and later I think in this podcast you're going to touch on some different rules coming into possibility with the Big Bash in Australia. Crowe's Cricket Max was 40 overs, like in T20, 40 overs, instead of 20 overs each, it was four lots of 10, because Martin Crowe and his genius, if you like, could see that if Brad Hodge got out for naught early in the first 10 overs, you could see Hodgie bat again in a full house at the MCG, got a naught in the first 10, but he could bat again in the next 10. And Crowe's initiative was like very Americanized, max zones, very noisy, but again, the four innings, which brought test match cricket to the fore as well, and he loved the initiative. It was all about 11 players. It wasn't six aside, it wasn't super eights or whatever. It was a full complement. He liked to expand into the idea of substitute fielders and all that, and that was coming to develop.
But we was it a double hit straight down the ground as well?
Yeah, six became 12, and four became eight. And you guys are very Aussie rules orientated, of course, with the big posts up. You had a flag umpire that gave it almost a bit of that when it went through to guide it, watch it, go for six, which was 12-4, all that sort of thing. So he had a max zone painted on the ground. I don't know if you guys – it was way ahead of his time, Crowe, massively. And I think it's T20 in terms of the franchise leads around the globe, chaps, that's got another – it's got another legacy to go.
And what about the IPL itself? Like, I just remember when you started to get going, I was thinking, you were talking about pantomime, I was thinking more about the WWE, with the way that you used to introduce the captains at the toss. And then, you know, someone like Gorton Gambier, who's a very introverted character, the dynamic between again. You and him. Is it Gorton Gambier?
Gordon.
TG.
Yeah, love
sorry.
You.
Oh, I love the double G.
You.
It's not working.
Yeah, because you could have fun with it, and it just flowed because you had the Dally Daredevils, the double Ds, you had the double Rs with Rajasthan, and here you had Gautam Gambier, who really didn't want to show the fangs, did not want to show the ivories, and he just crossed the coin and counted, and I loved introducing him. Here we go, he's the $2 million man. And he always looked at you like, I don't know that. Didn't pay that much to play in this. This other persona that was just, I try to make him smile and have fun with it, and he was just so focused and so dour. He added to it too, because I was at one spectrum end and he was at the other. Obviously, it was just madness.
No, I can relate to that, Danny. There's no doubt. I had a massive stash with GG, believe it or not, in the Kolkata Knight Riders gymnasium up the top, you know, above the pool area at the hotel. And I don't know where it came from. I think he was just an angry little unit at that stage. And somehow I must have maybe used his dumbbell, which was I wasn't allowed to touch or something. And GG cut up rough. And, of course, you know, it was a little stinging match because we were playing later that night. And I was on the bench. Anyway, he was pretty comfortably in telling me how crap I was. And that's why I was sitting on the bench. It was pretty funny. And then going back down that path, a few years later, it's amazing how more relaxed he was once he'd won a few titles, and it was pretty cool to then actually just talk some cricket with him. And I think he was just driven to try and succeed and emulate a few other legends in the game, and he was pretty determined to do well. And he's also a lot more comfortable with the $2 million price tag too, for the best part of 4 years. That helps as well.
So. Definitely, yeah.
And who do you like working with? I mean, there's some serious characters in you know, those commentary boxes in the IPL led by you, but there's a good flavour of New Zealanders as well. Does that make you feel a lot more comfortable in that environment, which lasts for a long time? You know, it's 10 weeks.
Mm.
It's hard travel. Just explain to, you know, the listeners that it can be difficult how hard you do have to travel.
Mm. Well, in a way, it's lost a little bit of its romance in a way, and I get that because it's so hectic now, and plus there's a different broadcaster that's taken over from IMG, which was run out of the UK for the BCCI, and they had it for the first 10 years with Sony. So now it's gone to Star, and the blueprints changed a bit because you used to have your zones a bit. You know, you'd have to be in Hyderabad, Bangalore, and go to Calcutta and do that sort of zone. Now with ABCD units, you don't have that. You sort of zigzag everywhere, and you can run into guys. There was at one stage, I remember doing a match in Mahali, probably only, might have been even 2 or 3 years ago, and there was Dool, Styrus and Morrison. The three Kiwis were on all together at once, which you sort of looked at and you thought, it's a bit silly, a bit naughty really in terms of the, you know, the rostering, because you've got to have a flavour with an Indian guy, and you could have an Aussie, Kiwi and an Indian, surely. And that's what they tried to do. They always tried to have an Indian on. I understand. So, right. So, yeah. When you've got three commentators on. Personally, I like two for T20 because then there's more interaction with your co-commentator. You can probably embellish a little bit of a story if you've got time, because we know you generally don't. But you can have a bit of fun with your co-commentator, or go down and say, let's throw it down and catch up with Mel Jones sideline or whoever it is, another Hollywood check that's all dolled up and looking great. That works. But, you know, with three of you, you've got to get boom, boom, boom. And the guys that get it, that flow with it and are in and out and short and sharp and punchy, it often works. And, you know, guys like Simon Dool have done it for a long time. And now Haydos has come and he adds another thing to it. You know, I used to really enjoy with Ravi because he was so loud and up. And it meant, in a way, and Flem, you guys will get this, that in commentary, it didn't feel like you were constantly either carrying guys to be up and doing your thing, because you have to be loud and people go, my God, why are you so over the top? You're just yelling at me. Well, you get drowned out. When you listen to yourself back on like a highlight reel, you might be even at an airport and they're running it and it's going, you hear yourself because the noise, the intensity is so much that you get drowned out. If we're just talking normally like this at this octave, you're going to get drowned out. So, and as you know, Flem and Hodgie, the atmosphere and the energy lends itself to be so boom, 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 up. It's such a great tournament.
And just on that, how do you think it would have been, or how do you think it's going to be in the future without a crowd? Because as you mentioned, you flow off that energy in the crowd and the game itself. How do you think that's going to pan out in the future?
Well, let's go to Wankhede, where if it's full for 33,000 people, they're talking about maybe only a third because of the social distancing thing and having a third of it. I think India, in a way, is spoiled, Hodgie, because they make a lot of noise anyway. It doesn't matter if you're a 10-year-old. Where you're a 70-year-old, it's just seeing the fans. They're just so obsessed and so fanatical. They get up for it. A bit like Aussie rules and you're yelling out and screaming for ball or kill that guy. they're in Melbourne. I just think the fanaticism is extraordinary. So when I look at all that, it will be, you're right, it'll be such a different landscape. And let's see, because, you know, I do the CPL in the Caribbean. I've done all those last seven of those. And they're talking again, if it goes ahead this September, that what are they going to do? Have, you know, 25% of the capacity of the stadia. You love the music, the vibe. And again, that's about the human interaction with the fan base, with the music and the partying, which is different again than anywhere else. But it relies on that. So you're right. A good question. It's going to be fascinating to see how that develops.
I think short of the game, we're going to notice the lack of crowd. I think for one day cricket, and that Excellent. Is a test cricket, it's not going to be as significant.
Boom! Oh, yeah! That's that! The last three deliveries, 6-4-4. When is it going to stop?
Now, Danny, we're going to go all the way back to your cricketing career, big fella. Two-part question. Did you have a family history in cricket? And when did you discover that gorgeous outswinger?
No family history because I tended to be more winter code. And you guys, of course, Melburnians, love your Aussie rules. And I found that fascinating to go along because my father lived out in a little bit of St Kilda and then was out in the Dandenongs in Belgrade. And I remember, you know, just visiting and seeing this crazy thing called Aussie rules. And so rugby, obviously rugby union when I was young. So classic Kiwi thing of rugby and being a nasty little halfback or winger. I used to play a bit of both. But then, you know, got dragged off to the northern suburbs and people went surfing, sailing and played, oh, you play cricket? What's that? It's splendid. And so, you know, did something completely different. And then I saw Lillian Hadley in 1977, those two protagonists locking horns and getting amongst it at Eden Park and watching that on TV going, that looks cool. I'd like to do that. But started out as Rodney Marsh because we're lacking in guys to catch the ball. I said, Danny, why don't you try a bit of keeping? And I was, you know, I was 11 and 12. I said, oh, yeah, yeah. And plus you're a midget. You know, let's just get the gloves on. I don't know how you're going to go try and run up and let the ball go. Oh, yeah. And so then you, of course, grew, maybe lucky if I grew a couple of inches and I was lucky. And then by the time I got to 13, which is what, 1979, you know, put the sweatbands on and pretended I was Hadley and Lily and doing impersonations and having fun. And that sort of took over. And watching a lot of some Aussie cricket snippets would get some of that. I went to the MCG in 19, and this will be good for your podcast, 1981. Dennis Lilly had just taken the world record, gone past Lance Gibbs. The last day they opened it up free because, of course, I think you needed, what, two or three wickets to get for the Aussies to beat the Windies. He just got Viv out the night before and Lily had like 4 for 10. And it was just the moustache, the hair, the great rhythmical running in. And a lot of us, as you wear Hodgie, the same for you, Flip, all of us, the thing of Dennis Lilly and the crowd chanting and what a theatre. Inspired a lot of us Kiwis as well. Yeah, we had Hadley. And when you look at the way Hadley that's finished his career, whereas Lily was a lot more earlier and was such an artist and such a character, just dynamic. We all wanted to emulate that. And that's where it stemmed from. Those two going together head-to-head, 77 seeing it, and then, of course, the one-day stuff, the underarm summer, 81, all of that really allowed, in a way, it did us the best favour for cricket over rugby for a change. It was huge. And so that underarm game and that summer, that beginning of 81, was so powerful for a lot of us to take up the game, get more engrossed in it and love it. And so I take my hats off to, you know, with the pyjama game, the lights and the first time New Zealand got invited to it, 80-81. That's what I love doing. And as you say, Flem, with, you know, being a little bit more slingy on the clock at about 1 o'clock, lent itself to an outswinger and then, you know, wanted to keep developing. And the other part of this, answering that question, so spoiled that New Zealand cricket was shrewd enough to say to Dennis Lilly through, I think it was Shell, Shell Oil Company, we'll pay for you to come over to New Zealand cricket. And that was 1985 to 1989. They paid him a five-year contract. Wow. He came over, saw a lot of us young guys, you know, Willie Watson, Murphy Sewer, all that sort of that ilk of sort of guys that are now early, you know, mid-50s. We got to see Dennis Lilly in that time, 85 through to 89. And it was fascinating have that coaching. Yeah, to have Lilly when we were sort of 19, 20-year-olds, and a few of us had back injuries, to then get into the New Zealand side. Here's a nice little anecdote. Saw the great DK when we played in that 87 MCG test match, the big French test, and I saw Fott about day three, and he was visiting, of course, Simon O'Donnell, who'd been diagnosed, right, with the cancer and on his rib. And the great Dennis Lilly was visiting Scooby in hospital. And so ran into him outside the G as we were leaving a day's play. It was just really, really nice to say, mate, well done, because he said again, you're not the tallest guy going around. There would have been a lot of naysayers that would said, mate, sorry, you know, going back, or why don't you become a spin bowler? And he was instrumental in motivating me to say, look, get fitter, you know, stay lean. Your timing and your action, that run-up is so important. As we all know, Flem, rhythm is the key.
Yeah.
So he was amazing for me. And there's no doubt. People, oh, what about Richard Hadley? Because you opened the bowling with him and he was my mentor. But the guy that did it for me was the great DK Lilly, because of that. Coming to New Zealand and in 85 and I had a back problem, and he said, mate, it depends how much you want it. It comes from in here. How much you deeply desire to want to run in and hurt, because it's going to hurt you. There's no doubt. If you want to bowl quick, it is not an easy thing to do. And so he's the man, without a doubt.
And just leading into that tour, your first tour, 87, 88, you debuted up at the Gabba. You know, what were your thoughts there? And then, as Hodgie alluded to, the famous Boxing Day test that summer.
Isn't that funny? I've just had the last one where New Zealand played and got run over this last summer. And it was the first time in 32 years. And yes. People go, isn't that obscene? But it just shows you, when you allow, you know, South Africa came back into the fold, India became a powerhouse, you've got your Ashes, which is the be-all and end, of course it is. And so really the little cousins across the ditch, well, look, we love you and we might invite you over occasionally to play, you know, the World Series, and have a couple of laughs and party up and get you drunk and have a good time. But really, the thing of the Boxing Day test, clearly New Zealand just wasn't the same draw card as South Africa being let back into the fold, bigger cricket nation, no doubt. And you had India powerful, Pakistan from time to time with their great side, you think, in those 90s. And so, yeah, we were left out a little bit in the cold there and played in different parts of Australia with the test series. And that, to me, was huge, because here it was, as you say, Flem, 1987, and you're playing with the great Richard Hadley, Ewan Chatfield, the Crow Brothers, Bracewell Smith. They had a very good side. That 80s era was powerful for New Zealand.
Yeah.
And for me to tag on the end of it and get an opportunity to play in Australia, to play at MCG test box, Christmas Day 1987, I was at my father's place with my little half-sister who was turning four, and my dad's second wife, Heather, and I was there for Christmas morning. And, of course, you know, the old man dropped us back to the old Hilton across from the MCG, and it was just really lovely, memorable times to be involved. So, and not blowing smoke up your guys' backsides, Melbourne is such a real heartfelt, warm place for me in my history and memory of being there because of my father's connection there. And really it was, you know, that theatre, the G, doesn't get bigger. Amazing.
It's definitely one of the best times to be in Melbourne across that Christmas period with the lead up to the Boxing Day test. Then you move into the Australian Open tennis. It is a pretty cool place. What was the crowd like, Danny, you know, when you first walked out onto the stadium? You know, was it jam-packed early on, or did it build up later in the day? And what did it peak at? Do you remember?
Well, of course, it wasn't what it is today, because that great Southern Stand was built for that World Cup final in 92, wasn't it? So you're going back to the old style, which, again, that had its romance too, because it wasn't quite this amazing, you know, theatre that it is today. And I just recall, and of course you'll love this, you guys will love this, because, you know, the crowd, and the Aussies, good crowd, building up, and there was that, of course, that Trans-Tasman rivalry. New Zealand had a good side. We had that. We never lost a test series in the 1980s at home. Never lost a test series.
Yeah.
Quite an achievement for, you know, the sheep herders that loved the sheep. And so when I think about being there, and of course we had Ewan Chatfield. Ewan, you know, the old Ewan. Sheep, and that constant around the ground. When we were warming up, they'd be, you mongrels, you're going to get eaten, you know. Yeah, lambs to the slaughter scenario. And so we'd, you know, do the warm-ups, crowded build-up. And it was extraordinary because I just remember, again, another one of those post-luncheon dinner chats, and you'd come along and tell some stories. And I'll never forget being down in the skies. And that's where it all started. He goes, "Morrison, effing and blinding Morrison, you effing mongrel." He goes, "Listen, I've heard of sheep having their tails docked, but my Jesus Christ, who docked your legs, you little muppet?" Just coding like that, spraying your viewer berth down at Bay 13.
Just constantly
was just a door. Yeah, quite different. "You little muppet." He goes, "Watch out for that. Watch out for that big pussycat. It's coming to eat you. Those other garden gnomes," and effing and blinding, all those expletives struck. "But look out for those garden gnomes. How there were you alive?" It was just all on. It was great fun. It was good fun.
But, Danny, it was an awesome test match because I think if you'd won it, you'd drew the series and retained the trophy.
Yes.
So, yeah, the Aussies needed 2-4-7. They were going to fall short of that, so they had to block it out. And you've got the ball in hand with your idol, Richard Hadlee. I shared the footage yesterday. Hindsight, right. Was it worth an appeal, that ball that just shaped into to McDermott? Was it worth the appeal?
And when I look at that feed on, like, with social media these days, there was definitely two sounds. Sure, there was two sounds. And when I looked at it, I loved it. Rod Marsh was commentating, and there was a couple of instances during that series. I remember Rod, and it's just so dry, goes, "Oh, I think the New Zealanders, I can feel a little undone there. I feel a little unlucky about that." You know, just giving it how he thought. It was great because others have said, you know, "Chap, I know, I was probably swinging a bit down leg." And no. I just tried to get it full. And the ball was a bit old. It wasn't obviously, clearly it wasn't a brand new ball. And it was just a nice older ball, you know, and suddenly I try to just hold it seam up. I just want to go full. I wanted to get it, obviously, hit the poles or an LBW, clearly, or that little nick down the channel. So when it tailed in slightly, wow, that freaked, you know, it just threw it right up because it just come in enough. And there, unwittingly knowing it, that would have been a bit of reverse with the shiny side still on that side and the rough side wanting to go away as an outswinger. Didn't. And it just tailed just enough. And that's why I think when I'll never forget appealing and falling back blue Melbourne sky, I think, if he's not going to give us, so I was giving the full expletive going myself, and then just got up and marched back, and, you know, what can you do? He's going to get
on.
I think people have asked me too in recent times, what would you, if I'd been an older, more experienced campaigner, might have had a crack, sure. But you couldn't, of course.
Nah.
At that time, you just were so young, just boom, in the situation, get on with it.
And what was it like in the dressing rooms afterwards? Big Wit blocked out the over from Sir Richard. Was there much talk about the LB straight away and how much disappointment? That, as I said, a lot riding on it. That one wicket, you've actually retained the Hadlee Chapel trophy.
Yeah. Well, that's right. It was very much, as you say, that decision changed the course of a series because you also cricket tragics, or, you know, what do you call them in Aussie, cricket nuffies, lovers of the game, all of us that love the game so much, will know that stat of Lilly, Chapel and Marsh had retired in January of 84, so almost 4 years later. And, of course, Australia hadn't won a home series. They got run over by Gat, didn't they, in that Ashes series of 86, 87.
Yeah.
You know, you think of all of that time before that because of the Rebel Tour, Kim Hughes and you know, that had been gutted, that Aussie side. Yeah, they'd all gone to South Africa, hadn't won a series. It was really important to win a home series post those three famous names of Lilly, Chapel and Marsh, and that allowed them to do that. And I think the weight of Alan Border's shoulders was immense. And I'll never forget being on the boundary. We were just so deflated and so gutted. Yeah. And again, I think particularly for Ian Smith and Richard Hadlee and Ewan Chatfield and all those guys have been around with the underarm game of 81. Also, I think Jimmy Higgs was given out too for intimidatory bowling of Lance Kens in 1980 at the Boxing Day Test match. And that was blocked out again by Australia. And so here we were feeling undone in another again. Boxing Day Test match. Yeah. And so I'll never forget, Border came out and he was shaking hands feverishly. He was so over the moon and rapt and ripping it up. And I can get it from AB's corner, absolutely, totally. And what he'd been through with that Aussie side getting smashed for a few seasons, it was, but again, for me, it was surreal. You're sitting around and there are the Aussies going about and our guys, and just seeing the exhausted Richard Hedley who'd run in that whole last session. I think he bowled 11 overs on the trot.
And he wasn't young either, Dave.
He would, what are we talking 38 about?
36? Or something, 36. Yeah,
it was at that time. And Hodgie touches on a good point. Because it was the old stadium, and the vibe in it, it was like a cauldron. You didn't get the breeze in it. It was sticky. It was really hot. One of those hot Melbourne days, late 30s. Poof, tough gig, but an amazing time.
Did you just woof then, Hodgie?
No, it's my dog, Flynn. I don't know what's
That's
going
what I'll say.
But you've, just leading into the great AB, you knocked him over 8 times in Test match cricket.
Oh, playing against Border, yeah, loved him. Loved, I think, well, all of us, you know, you think about that, Hodgie wanting to smash good bowlers, you're in your day, pitch is panned out a bit, whatever, and you've been in a good run of form, purple patch, you love smashing bowlers around. Same for us, bowlers, Flynn, isn't it? You know, you want to get out good players or, you know, with, you know, just the way it is in Test cricket. And so very fortunate that we played Australia a lot, New Zealand, in those late 80s up to about 93 when AB was still around. And it was nice in a way for a lot of us who played in 87 and the end of that Hadley era that finished in 1990, finished and got knighted in England in 1990.
Yeah.
And then to, I think we won a one-off test match. We drew in Perth in late 89, and then the return one-off test we won in New Zealand conditions in a very rain-affected short test match. In 1990, Hadley's sort of sign-off in New Zealand was lovely for him. And then we drew that series. We bought his last test series. It was one-all, which is a bit like how we were hoping it was going to be in late 87, but we had to wait till the beginning of 93 to retain the Trans-Tasman trophy on that side of the game. So I got a taste of it at either end of the career to do that. And to get Border, as you say, because he's left-handed and for us, Flem, swinging it back in, get him a couple of times LB.
Yeah.
You know,
no, you got him 4 times over. LB. You bowled him once.
Loved it.
Who else was up there
fun.
In Test cricket? You had AB, but you would have bowled to some of the greats, really. Who did you rate in that top sort of 3-5 batsmen you bowled to?
I think you can't go past Javed Mehndad and played a full series there in Pakistan with difficult. And they, obviously, that we all know now, scratching at the ball and just manipulating it a little bit and tweaking it and it going around corners. So they had Wasim and Waka. We got run over, what do you got? We got run over 3-0 in the test match. It's 3-0 and 5-0 in the one dayers because of those two. And they also Akib Javed and a couple of other good stars as well and a bit of spin.
Was that the infamous series where Chris Pringle or you decided that things were happening, we'll go a bottle top and Chris, who was an excellent one-day bowler, you know, took something like 12 wickets, didn't he? You guys sharpened up one side and nothing was said about it. You just went on.
Well, the great thing, another little story about that was that we were going to do that and we wanted to test it and work it out. And so Martin Crowe, who used to bowl only in swingers, had some good pace too, I might add. When in his heyday, he would have been easily 140 when he got it right. Strong, big guy, and he only really bowled in swingers to right-handers. Well, as soon as we turned the other side into a chess pattern and carved it up, it went the other way from him. And he was like, he's the captain of the New Zealand team. He was like a kid in a candy shop. And it was going both ways like a boomerang. And he goes, geez, I can't wait for tomorrow. You know, I've got to have a go. And so when we did do that, it was ridiculous because they had no neutral umps. And that wonderful little story that Chris Pringle used to tell at luncheons and stuff, and then we all came together in the ump for a drinks break, and they saw the ball, and they looked up and smirked, both the umpires, and looked at everyone, and the batters were in earshot. Oh, look, one thing. Now, boss, I'm just teaching. Really? You think that? You go, honestly.
And McCullum will be back for an early shower. And the dancers are running for cover. Boom! Holy guacamole!
Now, Danny, you played in 3 World Cups, I believe, and you led yourself back to Australia in the 1992 World Cup, or 1993 World Cup, sorry. Talk us through that experience coming back to the Australian shores, and what did you think your chances were when you first came here?
Well, that World Cup was so unique because all of the previous ones were all played in white clothing with a red ball. Yeah. England, and then, of course, the subcontinent was 87, which the Aussies had won. And remarkable. Again, you couldn't have scripted it better. Played the Poms in the final and beat Gatting and co. So then you fast forward to 92, and there's an expectation, I think, for the Aussies playing at home. They knew the final was going to be at the MCG. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot there, I think, more on the Aussies in terms of being defending champs. Us on the other side of the coin, across the Tasman, we just got beaten by England 3-0 in a one-day series and in the Test series. It was the first time we were all very deflated, Hodgie, because we'd lost the Test series the first time at home in New Zealand since the great Richard Hadlee retired a couple of years before. And I think it was the previous one was 1979 against Pakistan. So all those 1980s, never lost a home Test series. Lost that to England, lost 3-0. We didn't give ourselves a fighting chance in the media and everybody else, but the late, great Martin Crowe, he said, this is our strategy. And he talked about every other team as if we're playing the blue team. Right, now we're up against the green team or the yellow team. He never mentioned who they were. He never wanted to get into specifics of the opposition. He talked about our skill set. What can we bring to the table and what are we going to do?
Yep.
Shitty little slow tracks. It was the introduction of Diddly, Dobbly and Wobbly. You know, you're Chris Harris. You had a little bit of Gavin Last. You know, going either smoothly standing up or not very far back. And you had a bit of Rod Latham as well when the ball got a bit older and softer. Plus the genius.
Six-pack Patel.
Six-pack Patel, baby. Yeah. Locked on up to the old bottle-o and cut loose and gave it plenty. So pace off the ball was brilliant. And so the strategy of playing to our strengths, given our conditions on really rugby grounds, was amazing. And our goal, believe it or not, our goal early on in that start of that World Cup was, hey, let's see how we go at the start of this and what we can achieve. Our goal has got to be to make a home semi-final. Got to be a home semi-final. Eden Park had one of the semi-finals. The Aussies had the other semi, and of course, no brain, the big final, the G. And we achieved that. It was amazing. Seven on the trot. And then, of course, at some point, your bubble bursts. It's a bit like India at the World Cup in England in 2019. Played so beautifully, so dominant. At some point, something's going to come a little unhinged in tournament play, and it did for the Indians last year. Same for us. We lost to Pakistan, last round robin game, and then lost the semi-final to them, the same opposition a few days later.
And just I was fascinated watching Patel open the bowling and, you know, working out that the batsman absolutely had no idea. What was the, you know, there was a couple of moments in World Cups where a coach or a captain had played those moments. One was that, the other one was opening with Kulawithurana and Jayasuriya, Sri Lankans going, you know, hell-bent. What was the feeling like as an opening bowler to see, you know, an off-spin bowler take the brand new Kookaburra and wheel out 10 overs straight? How did you guys receive that?
Well, again, that was between Crowe and the coach Warren Lees, and they had to decide we've got to do something extraordinarily different. We've got to do something unique to get in the heads of the opposition and stuff them up. The great thing about Dipak is that originally from Worcester. And came to New Zealand, played as a club pro, got to play first-class state cricket, married a local Indian lady, Veena. He wanted to stay. So he was staying and committing to New Zealand. And he also played so much first-class cricket out on like a, you've been there, the number two ground, it's a bit like the nursery ground. Right? Yeah. He used to bowling first-class time because the thing was such a Bunsen out the back. He would often open the bowling with me, or depending who else, you know, it could have back in the day, it could have been a bit of Willie Watson or Chris Pringle or, you know, whoever. He'd open the bowling on those Bunsens and was used to bowling with a new seed. So that was also a positive and a plus that he could do that. And he wanted to do it. He's happy to do it. He's happy to take up the challenge, 22 men out of course, to do that on small grounds and back themselves. And that game against Australia, that opening game where Crowe got 100, set it up. And on that brown, low surface, really did give us a lot of confidence and for those other dibbly part-timers.
It really was a bit like Sri Lanka 4 years later. I mean, obviously, lucky Sri Lanka went all the way and won the final. You guys didn't. We need to talk about Martin Crowe too, the late great Hogan. You know, I just, as a batting purist, you know, I thought technically he was as good as I ever saw. But in that series, his batting went another level. The captaincy, the innovative batting, but also the bowling changes as well. You know, what was it like being around Hogan throughout that series? And then also, you know, just chat about, you know, his batting brilliance.
He was one of those guys that had been very focused and wanted to be the best he could possibly be. And so when you look at the way he went about things and wanted to achieve, I tell you, it was a great analogy recently. I don't know if you guys have been watching the great Michael Jordan, The Last Dance, that's on Netflix at the moment. Yep. So when I look at that, Crowe's in that sort of mindset where he wants to win, he wants to dominate, he wants to stamp his authority on the game. And so when I look how focused he was extraordinary. And it was good for us guys that were a little bit younger than him to be around that and then to have some sort of more self-belief, because, of course, he was up here at that level. And again, you look at that Last Dance with Jordan's up here and there's, you know, quite a few as everyone else is there. I mean, Pippen, pretty special too, Scottie Pippen. But he brought that out of those other guys, didn't he? Dennis Rodman. They all got lifted to another level, really, because of someone like Jordan. And so I look at Crowe, you know, he lifted, you know, again, Andrew Jones, there was a little bit of edgy competitiveness. Jonesy was so freakily different and a weird, weird technique and a bit of a different character. And it brought the best out of each other. And then on top of that, it gave Mark Greatbatch some self-belief too. He took that World Cup where he said, listen, you've got a license here. I want you to go as a Crowe. I want you to go out. And they were good mates at grammar school together. I want you to go out, I want you to have a free license, cut loose, do what you know you can do. And so Crowe had that ability to lift you. And it was no surprise when he was captain at times, I felt good. He was also like a bowling captain, because I mentioned earlier in that Fires the Bad Test where we scratched the ball up, he ran in and bowled a bit. He actually bowled in Test cricket. I think of that 1985 Test match where they played a lot of spinners, New Zealand. He opened the bowling with Richard Hadley in 85 because it was more of a Bunsen. And he could. Because he also thought like a bowler. And that, Flem, you would have loved that, where you got a batting star captain, but really he also thought for you in terms of field setting. I said, mate, I'd love a guy at third man. He said, Danny, I know that too, but I'd rather have another slipper, another gully. Well, why don't we go with another gully? But what take? I know you've got Nick down there, but I want you to still get in close, and I want you to variety, but I still want you to nick this guy out. I don't care if you get driven through the covers of it. I don't care if you get nicked a third man. Let's get him out. So there was all of that thinking.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and so he was great for that. And he was a marvellous character. As much as he got a little bit in his own, and I think, as we all know, Hodgie and you know, great players really did it. They got immersed in their own thing of it. And you had to be a bit selfish like that. I think when you're that level, Hadley, all those guys, Lilly, Greg Chappell, you know, Viv Richards, they get into that zone and that's it, and they're doing their thing. And so, you know, that speaks to me volumes with Michael Jordan. You get to see in that doco all that footage and all that time lapse, isn't it? He had to be that sort of ruthless in a way. And Crowe at times could be like that ruthless to do that well. And that World Cup where he stood up, poof, extraordinary.
Hodgie, I don't know if you saw Martin Crowe that much, but you know, I think Wasim Akram said he was the hardest batsman to bowl to because he played so late with reverse swing. But, you know, we've got some really good technicians now going around, you know, Coley and Williamson. But, you know, I think Crowe technically was as good as a batsman that I played against. It was amazing. Hey, just finishing with one day cricket. March 25th is a significant date in the world. Yeah, Elton John's birthday. But even bigger than that, March 25th, 1994, Danny Morrison takes a hat-trick in one-day cricket.
Is it really Elton John's birthday? Is Elton's birthday then, is it?
Yes. When you look up the date on the internet, Elton's at number two, March 25th. Morrison's hat-trick's number one.
Wow.
Do you know who you got out?
It's not surprising.
Well, it's funny, with you on slow coach, of course, we're getting into that thing soon, aren't we? That's exciting too, another avenue. Slow coach is in terms of sending in some footage, and I just thought, look, because that was going for me, I'll send that in. Anyway, when I look at the whole thing of the reverse ball and the white ball getting old, we didn't have to change it at 34 overs back in those days. You know, the batters go, oh, I can't see, it's gone a bit grey. Can we change the ball? You know, because it's harder and it doesn't swing reverse as much and batters could buff it. So we didn't. And it was around, must have been around 42, 44 over, something like that. And I just remember just getting it up there and saying, look, it's going to get starting to go. And, of course, just gently scratch it a little bit more. And then one side was shiny with the saliva and what have you, not allowed to use these days on the landscape. And, of course, just getting it just went beautiful and late. And loved it. And so when I think about that time of just trying to get it full in York, guys, those are probably the three best balls I bought. The one to Capel Dev, but the other one, the next one was, what was the next one? The next one was Ancola. He went on to do some.
Yeah, that was a guy. I'd never heard of him. That's why I asked you. Yeah. I wasn't sure if you'd get
big,
the second
big
one.
Big medium pacer. Yeah, big tall guy, strong guy. And then, of course, Mollier got pushed down the batting order, the keeper. He wasn't the worst, but
good player.
He got pushed down the order. So bad luck, and he got knocked out. It was the next ball. It was the first ball, another over. So it was quite weird. Yeah. You go, oh, shit, your crowd's got noisy. And I escaped and thought, oh, shit, yeah, there's a hat trick on offer here. Because you just, you know, hat and glasses, down the third man, relax, get a drink, you know. And I went, oh, yeah. I gave my hat and sunnies to the ump. I went, oh, yeah. Shit, it's on. And it came out nicely.
And it certainly was an advantage back then. It would have been when you were first starting, Hodgie, you know, just the one ball over 50 overs. Most times you didn't really, you just had to shine one side, didn't you? And it got softer, the kookaburra, and it went. It actually wasn't a bad time to actually be bowling.
No, I can remember that, boys. And I think it's an art which actually creates more theatre for the game. I really believe that in all forms of cricket. I think that whenever the ball moves, whether it be reverse or conventional, is great. And, you know, I think that, you know, even those masters, when you do need eight and over and the ball is reversing, you have to find different methods instead of just pumping it into the grandstand. So, you know, I'd like to see that come back, actually, and I'd like to see the batters just try and adapt and find a different method. So I really enjoyed watching that part of the game.
Absolutely.
And, Hodgie, we talked about go, Dan.
Just a bias, aren't they? Aren't the kookaburra trying to say, because you know, like the saliva and the COVID thing, you're not allowed to put saliva on the ball anymore. They're talking about, you know, like a bias in the ball to make it go, because batsmen have had the bats develop and get fatter and get boshed. They're talking about perhaps putting a bias in the ball to help it down the air.
And is that the weight bias?
Yeah, just something that will make the ball go once, like a bowls ball, like a lawn bowl.
Well, actually. Yeah, well, actually, Warney was the one, you know, that come up with that. But the thing is, I'd like to know the aerodynamics, that if you've got it weighted on one side, but that gets scratched up, does it actually balance it up and it goes straight? Like, I don't think that theory will actually work. But I thought you're going to lead on to, because of the pandemic we're in, that kookaburra come up with a potential wax if we can't use saliva and sweat.
Oh, right.
As long as it's the same for both team, I don't mind that. But Pat Cummins come up with a good point. If we can't use at least our sweat, you know, should we really be playing? Because I'm assuming all the players will get tested before they play. If they're all negative, then surely you can use your sweat. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, you're covered in it and you can't get away from it, can you? What are you going to do? It's part of it. You just naturally do that anyway, but it's dripping off you and on your. I just remember in Aussie, in other hot parts of the world particularly, that it did get on your fingers and there was no getting around it. As much as you try to keep your hands dry, like sweatbands or towel, I mean, you use that thing, didn't you? The towel on the front there to keep your bowling hand dry, but you still got it on there.
Maybe we can schedule all cricket in Dunedin and Hobart and see how everyone goes.
You like it, Hodgie, don't you? Tassie.
It's a good call, Hodgie, because I'm thinking Colombo. Like, how much sweat do you get there in places like Cochin, Gabba? You know, there's no way you're going to sweat. Hey, Hodgie, I asked whether you'd seen Martin Crowe bat.
Yeah.
Don't worry about Crowe. Did you see the great Danny Morrison bat?
Well, no, because he never lasted that long. I did see him bat a couple of times. And, it was probably... He probably played before the time where traditionally the lower order had to then start working on their game. So, I guess it was a bit of an unwritten rule. You get to about 8 or 9 down and you're not going to stick around. Let's get the bowling work done. So, but now we know how important it is for the tail enders to put work in. I think he was in that phase where, let's not hang around. Let's get the new ball in hand and get some wickets. So...
And like Danny, when did you first hear the name the Duck Hunter?
Well, the Duck Callers. The Duck Callers as well for testimonial season. Loved it. Yeah. So the whole theme around it is so, like, you can't take the piss out of yourself and be sort of thick-skinned enough. You're going to get smashed, aren't you?
Yep.
The whole thing about it was a duck tie, world record duck tie. It happened. Got the duck tie, should have gone and grabbed one. And then we had duck callers, the old duck callers we sold at the grounds. And we had duck on the menu, like for a luncheon or a dinner, we'd have duck. And then we'd have these chocolate ducks as a, an after dinner mint with chocolate ducks, mate. Beautiful. So it was the whole thing. Donald Duck, Daffy Duck, Danny Duck, and all these cricket bats. I think Gunnar Moore sponsored it. And we burnt a big hole in the bottom and signed a heap of them. And we sold a few of those. So It was a real marketing exercise. It was actually good fun. And if you can't poke fun at yourself, it's a bit boring in life, as we know, Flip. So you want to have fun and take the piss out of yourself. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
it was 24 test ducks. The battle I liked watching was D. Morrison versus Wasim Akram. You scored 8 runs against him. He got you 4 times.
Is that all?
Twice LB, once bowled.
The one I do that stands out, because I was batting with Martin Crowe, funny enough, in Karachi in 1990. And Wasim, of course, ball's a bit older at that stage, round corners, what price. Came out, one whistle past my shoulder, and then I played and missed another one. And then he's come round the wicket, and Crowe's at the other end, just leaning on his bat as if to say, just hang in here for 3 more balls, you know? And then all of a sudden, he's got left arm round, and it has come in like this banana and swinging thing. It was just outrageous. And I went to play, went through bat pad, just missed my front pad in between the bat and the off pole, went cartwheeling. Crowe said after, he's coming, goes, "What the hell were you doing? What were you thinking? You only had to just go forward. You know it's swinging. We've talked about this." It wasn't a bad tee. he wanted to spit on me.
I think that sounds very similar to Flem's experience against Wasim in Pakistan as well. Oh. Only that Flem managed to get him through the covers for one, I reckon. Flem, from memory, is that right? Yep, once.
And then he was just a different level. Hey, Danny, a lot of batsmen, restrict themselves to using their bat in defence. You, on one famous occasion, used your helmet. Can you dispel the myth that batsmen like to oil their bat? You'd actually oil your helmet before you went out to bat.
Oil the lid, baby. And it can fly off and you can get runs. Just pretend you're playing a bit of a shot. And now they like the sponsorship deal so much, I went to the full Monty and got my own.
Yeah, it's nice. Love it.
Talk us through it. Facing Carl Rackerman?
Yeah, they're facing Mocker and so... at the Wacker, and then Martin Sneddon at the other end, my club teammate, first-class state mate, and now New Zealand mate. And he goes, "Listen, it's getting dark here. I'm about to appeal against the light here. So for God's sake, do not get out now. There's 4 balls left. I want you to hang in here. So help me, I'll shove this bat where the sun doesn't shine." I go, "Thanks for the confidence." And that's just instilling plenty. And so you're cupping yourself there and all whizzing past. And so I've sort of just a couple of just gone past shoulder height. Mocker's that, you know, that nasty length when he's tall, strong, at
bottom,
bouncing at the old whacker. So this is 1989. And then I thought, well, look, I'll let a couple go. And then a third one, I just sort of splashed a bit and went, oh, okay. And then I thought, well, here we go. Last ball of this over, I reckon. I'm going to go forward. And I reckon it might just be hopefully a little bit further pitched up because he's bowled a couple of, you know, shoulder height, chest height. And I'll just go forward and just get him behind that so I don't get my poles or LB uprooted. Well, I went forward and hello, I went, no. And went, no. And say, listen, stuff the bat. Let's just use the lid. And went bang. And it was beautifully flush on. Flew out there. I'll never see Ian Healy running past and goes, an Aussie, a keeper of all, going, you okay, Dan? And that's what he said. Yeah. And I looked at him and went, oh my God. He's asking about my welfare if I'm okay. But it was just hilarious. I mean, clunk out the cover point. Brilliant. The things we do.
I mentioned in your intro, though, probably the highlight with the bat must have been that partnership. And Nathan Astle, what an underrated player. I mean, he was a power player. But, you know, you put on 106. Geez, the Poms must have been getting frustrated.
The great thing about this, or the story about it, was that I'd played a bit with Athers, who was captain. Mike Athers was captain. I played with him at Lancashire in 92, filling in for the great Wasim Akram. They'd won the World Cup. They were the tourists of 92 in England. So I got to go as their overseas pro. Played a bit with Athers because he'd had a bad back and was leading in with Lanks. So then he was captaining. I'd actually slogged a few in a Prime Minister's 11 game, got 30 and had a laugh because I was just slogging at Corky. And he said, come on, Corky, give us one. You got to hit this. You know I headbutt it. And I sliced him over the keeper and stuff like that. Got down Tufnell's in, and Tufnell said, "Tuff, why not? What do you reckon?" Well, they were laughing at me because I'd try to have some fun, and, you know, clearly towards the end of my career, I had a Hustler mag in my front pad. So I stuffed my front pad, which were getting pretty ordinary, right? These pads weren't great. So I stuffed a Hustler mag in my front pad to just boost it, you know. Get it up. So I didn't get, if I got it on the front, now I'd be right. So I had the Hustler mag there. They were all having a great laugh around the bat. And Alex Stewart's going, I cannot believe this, Morrison. What are you thinking? Oh, no, I just got it off the coach. I stuck it in my face. So I said to Tuffers, go on, give it some air. So he did. And I said, come on, why not? I'll let the sixer out. So I slogged them for two beautiful sixes and one over, another one and another over, and got to 30. And I thought, oh, that's how Morrison just pouring, gives it a lick, gets out. Come the test match, I didn't. I just stonewalled it. And the boys were just going, are you kidding me? Are you such a boring effing so? But they wanted to have a laugh. And so Nick Knight comes out. He goes, and you know what they're like. So you do those, you know, those player personality things and you play profile of likes and dislikes. I said, I do not like cold toast. And who's one of the guys that irritates you the most? Well, Dion Nash is like a fruit fly. He's just a pain in the butt.
No.
And I said, and so then you had Dion Nash with that thing and then the cold toast. And so Knighty was, they were quite polite about it. You guys were a bit different, right? Different sledges. And then I was going to go, oh, Let's get Nashy out here with some cold toast for Dan. See how he likes that. It was just trying to make me laugh and lose my concentration or whatever and just be silly. I mean, I had a lot of luck, let's be fair. Spinning it, Tuffer's got shittier and shittier, more flatter and flatter. Astle, block four against the other guys, and particularly against Tuffers, and Tuffers is ripping his hair out and got slogged here and there. And I was happy just to block it. Again, headbutted another one. Goffey getting forward earlier than New Nut. Clunk on the helmet. Loved it. They're all pissing themselves and having fun. And I just played and missed a bit. A couple of French cuts. Squirted a couple. And suddenly the whole lot. And, of course, I batted in sunglasses because batting at 11, legally, I could. Who gives a rat's, right? So I batted in sunglasses. Looked like the blind man coming up the bat. And amazingly hung around because they thought, oh, look, it's okay, Dan will be out. Just need, come on, Tuffers, just one, buddy. Just give one beautifully flighted delivery. And it just, yeah, he just got so irritated and so ratty with Astle boshing at the other end. It's hilarious.
What did you do for the 100th celebration? What did you do? Did you do something significant?
Dean Jones, saluting all corners of the stadium. Dino, here's one for you. Oh, it was just a lot. We went out on the town. It was lovely. We went on the town afterwards where I let get the ferry across, the lovely part of Devonport there, and had a wonderful seafood dinner and hung out. And then, you know, that was it. And the coach said, no, we're not here for your batting. You idiot.
Sod off. Gone. And just to finish your playing career, did you have a most, you know, I talked about Nathan Astle and his brother-in-law, McMillan, and did you have a teammate that you felt was really underrated?
Guys, sadly for Dipak, he got out in 99 in the 92 season against England prior to that World Cup. The man could bat, and he really just didn't show enough of his wares. And he batted up and down the order from 3 right down to number 8. He moved around. I think for him, the confidence thing that got shattered for him was that he didn't quite get enough runs when he needed to. Up against, you know, the two W's as well, let's be real, the two W's in their pomp, 1990 to 95, when they were, you know, really going. Then Waka had his injury, missed the World Cup 92. Waz was doing his thing. You know, he'd come up against them a bit. And I just think he was a guy that was a little underrated and should have got more out of himself for his all-round ability, because he's also a very useful off-spin bowler. Good fielder, good slipper at times. Geez, they dropped a lot of catches. You guys will laugh and remember. My God, he used to drop.
And one more. Who was best for team chemistry? I mean, you mentioned Dion Nash, who was a real mozzie, floating around singing songs and all that sort of stuff. Was he good for team chemistry, or was there someone else that really stood out?
I mean, Chris Pringle, everyone used to get stuck in that because he was just a big galah and just so silly. And he'd do stupid stuff. And then he'd get that coloured zinc, and he wanted a sponsorship. So he'd wear all the rainbow zinc through here on his nose and then just all that sort of palaver.
Yeah.
I used to get him. Guys that used to irritate you. I mean, Tony Blaine was naughty. If a guy done something really a bit offhand at the bar or was a bit rude, he'd drop a loaf in the guy's soap tray. He'd drop a loaf and leave it in there. So the next morning you come back and you're just
haunting
dressing room.
Oh,
jeez. You know, evil. That sort of thing.
Damn,
characters,
man.
Though, yeah.
Hey, Morrison, been excellent to talk about your commentary and playing career. Hey, boys, what about some current events? You know, what do we think is going to happen with the international summer? We're hearing, Hodgie, that the India are keen. I mean, that would just, you know, save the summer, wouldn't it, that if India would come and play tests. I think there'll be some conditions, maybe some extra one days. We know how much they rate back home. And then obviously the New Zealand Australian governments are talking the CEOs from respective cricket associations as well. How do you think it's going to play out, Hodgie?
Yeah, two things, Flem. I think that I definitely think India will tour at some stage. Where they're played and in what state and what crowds is an unknown, but I think that, you know, a couple of the big boards, England, Australia and India, will take it upon themselves to make sure that cricket does get back on track pretty quickly and pretty quickly financially. So that series is critical for Australia, critical for India, but also spreading the love around the globe. And then I think you'll find that an IPL will slide in there somewhere as well, if not two IPLs next year, to get the financial stuff back on track. Big Bash, look, I'm pretty confident. I was always a massive fan of having a Southern League when it started, you know, South Africa, Australia and New Zealand. And I'd be still pretty keen to find two New Zealand sides in the Big Bash at some stage. I reckon they'd lift the intensity, but also lift the standard as well. So have a Northern side and a Southern side, whether the powers that be at Cricket Australia think that's a good idea and whether they want to include little brother is a different matter. If not, trying to open up for the New Zealanders to be internationals, because I just can't see any international players being welcome here or being allowed to come here, for Big Bash, which is going to start probably earlier than normal this year.
Danny, what are your thoughts on the on the Big Bash? And, you know, I'd be sort of hoping that the New Zealand individual players could at least be able to play in it. And a big win, which it's obviously massive for the IPL and the CPL is to get the best domestic players playing. So we get the key Australian players playing in the Big Bash.
Definitely. We need that. That's the cornerstone of any entertainment package. You can't sell an entertainment package and not have the best entertainment on available. So, you know, I think that's critical. It's a real opportunity now that the calendar's been opened up to say, right, we want our Aussie players playing in this competition. I mean, we haven't seen David Warner play in the Big Bash League for many years, and yet he goes over to the IPL and he plays like a superstar and the Sunrisers Hyderabad love him. We need that here. It's our product and we need our best players involved for sure.
Yeah, look, totally, 100%. And I think that it just shows in the IPL, as you rightly point out, Hodgin, you want those key players playing in the Big Bash. I also just wonder, just because of COVID-19, remember the Indian board, the BCCI, don't allow any Indian players to play overseas. Well, now the landscape's changed. And I wonder if they could come down, given the timing, to those Indian players to play in the Big Bash, possibly. I'm just saying, again, it's all about quarantines. The Indian players came down in a whole summer. Tough, I know, tough for families. But if all those players came down to Australia, you've got them on the calendar in a test series and ODIs, right? Playing the Big Bash there, because they've talked about with Australia and New Zealand now, we've got spoiled down here in our own little bubble. And I think the Pacific Rim Nation's about flying in and out, basically because of economies, really. But when you look at it from a sporting entertainment, possibly that could be a scenario that if you've got, and we all know how big India is, those Indian players to come down, quarantine, train down here, be here for their series and the Big Bash, got the Kiwis next door, and come across and just say, hey, listen, that's what we're trying to do. It's a tri-series of old, but there's such a big base of players, clearly from India, to come down and possibly do that with the Kiwis and the Aussies and add that dynamic in there. Play on both sides of the Tasman.
Yeah, definitely. I like those ideas. Hodgie, you make sure Ashraina threw it out there to the BCCI to allow Indian players to play the bash. That was closed pretty quickly by a source from the BCCI.
Yeah, they always remain anonymous, those sources. But look, I can agree with the BCCI on that a little bit. They are protecting their franchise cricket, and that is IPL. It is the best brand on the globe. There's no doubt about that. And it holds the best players. If you open up the Indian players to the whole market, then that product will become a little bit diluted, maybe or maybe not. And then every tournament becomes just the same. The one thing I dislike about T20 at the moment is that you do roll around and just see the same players or the same international players in every tournament.
Yep.
So for me, that becomes a little bit mundane and boring. That's why I love the flavour of Indian Premier League, because we are glued to see how not only their superstars go, but also their super young talent go. And pinning all that talent against the international superstars actually makes it quite unique. If you open that door up for everyone, then I think it just dilutes it a little bit, which they don't want to do. So I can agree with that. As a player, if I was Suresh, yeah, I'd be busting to come out here and play, there's no doubt. But he's got to understand as well that as a management decision, they are protecting the golden goose and they're doing a pretty good job of it.
Just to finish up, Ian Chappell, Danny Morrison come out and he wanted to change the LB law that it didn't matter where it pitched, it hit the stumps. As an ex-bowler, are you happy with that?
That whole thing around the wicket. It's bizarre, isn't it? When I look at that Hodgie, of course, the Hodgie probably have a different view on it. But it is. It seems strange. It's just been like that forever, hasn't it? It pitches outside the big stump.
I don't like the pitched outside leg because that could have some defensive bowling. But if it pitches outside off, if it hits you outside the line of off, I'm happy for that. I'm happy for that to be given out.
Well, because you've also got technology,
use your back.
Of course, the same. Well, yeah, that too. And they're saying, aren't they? And that was saying, well, it's a couple of percent, maybe possibly with a little bit of difference, right? They're ball tracking. They're saying that's only that possibly out by a couple of percent of what's where that ball's tracking, hits you in line, where's it going on, the distance calculated, where you get hit on the crease or if you're behind the crease, more chance of getting out surely. But I do hear what you're saying. I like that from a bowling perspective.
Well, imagine, Danny, if that rule was in, you would have got AB 15 times. Sorry about that. All right, that's all we've got time for. Morrison, fantastic. I know you're scratchy, but could you do a coin toss, an IPL-type coin toss, Hodge and Fleming?
You two?
Oh, well, introduce brilliant. Us. Go.
Here we are, match 17, BBL for season 2021. Can't believe it. We've got the big one. We have the home sides, the Renegades up against the Stars. A full house. The roof is about to come off here at the G. Captains, here they are, Messrs. Fleming and Hodge. Toss. Who's calling? Hodge, are you calling?
Nice. Heads.
There's a tail. Flem, what are you going to do?
Bowl.
Good. I wasn't bowling. I want to have a bat anyway.
No changes. Danny Morrison, absolute star. Thanks for joining us on the Bowlology Report.
Love you,
thanks,
gents.
Danny. Brilliant.
Holy guacamole!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.